Welcome to the South America Files from These Football Times, brought to you by Manscaped.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode four. I've just checked off air. Episode four of the South America Files. And now we are moving across to Venezuela. First of all, Gary, welcome to the South American Files, part four.
Yeah, lovely series. South American football. They're like, they knit together so well, and the passion in South American football is magnificent. And as usual, we couldn't have a better guest to guide us through than Dr. Pete.
Dr. Pete. You actually look like you're in Venezuela, to be fair, Gary. If I didn't know any better, I'd say you'd actually gone for this one.
I am in Venezuela. I'm not far from the capital, just about 10 kilometres away towards the coast. And it's in the mountains. I'm in Spain. But, you know, it's the language is the same, so I'll count that. Take that on the nod. I'll count that.
Excellent. And Stephen, the vintage Liverpool shirt, obviously, at time of recording. Last night was the night.
It was. It was the big night. It was the big handover. And yes, still a very happy Liverpool supporter today. Yes, all is good with the world.
I feel like the conversations we've had over the last, well, literally probably 12 months now, is that, well, you know, we won't count our chickens, we'll just wait, you know, we won't tempt fate, but I think now, definitely, it's okay to start celebrating.
I think it's all right now. With a game to spare, we're going to allow this to happen now.
And obviously, as Gary mentioned, Dr. Pete, it's uni, it's PhDs, it's South America, it's all the stuff that you know about. Tonight, Venezuela. How is your Venezuelan football knowledge in comparison to other South American clubs? Yeah,
this is the one that I'm kind of got less knowledge about, but principally because it's just not one of the countries that really gets studied or talked about in terms of, you know, the kind of great panorama of Latin American football, you know. I mean, if you were to look through the kind of university libraries and journal articles, and you'd find loads of stuff about Brazil, you'd have loads of stuff about Argentina. But yeah, if you're trying to track down something about Venezuelan football, you're probably going to struggle a little bit. So yeah, this one took a little bit more research time.
Are you comparing your lack of knowledge to myself, Stephen and Gary, or to the people who know about Venezuelan football?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, like, what I have got behind me is a lot of at least Venezuelan history knowledge and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So at least the kind of the social processes and the politics and history is fairly solid, but... Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, it's just because, you know, the great Venezuelan football triumphs don't really jump off the page as much as some of the other ones. So.
Not really. Okay, well, let's make a start then. Obviously, you know, we'll sort of follow the sort of usual pattern that we seem to have fallen in with this one. So, you know, first of all, it's about, you know, the origins of the game within Venezuela.
Yeah, so this, again, so like many of the other South American nations that we've talked about, you know, again, we're looking at the kind of towards the end of the 19th century for where Venezuelan football really starts. In actual fact, they celebrated their 144th anniversary of the first game being played in Venezuela just last week. It was on the 16th of July in 1876, by all accounts, when there was a match played that was organised by a Welsh teacher called A.W. Simpson. In a place called El Caratal, which is near Callao. And again, like what we've often seen in the previous ones is that it's linked to British kind of maritime trading merchant interests, maybe some of the elite classes that go over to South America. This one is similar, but except this time it's mining for gold. So this is what A.W. Simpson and the other people around that area were doing. And this is where, you know, that apparently is where the first match was found. There's an old newspaper report which says, a match of football was played. So that's where it starts. But then there's a bit of a break. There isn't much report that I've been able to find. But it seems to be, one of the things that's most interesting about Venezuelan football is that it seems to be as much about an introduction for different colonies. They talk a lot in the early 20th century about football from the colonies. So we have groups of Spanish, groups of Portuguese, groups of Italians who come over and start playing football in their particular communities. And to be honest, really, they probably have more of an influence on the growth and development of Venezuelan football than any English influence really did. The English kind of merchant classes don't really establish themselves in Caracas and Maracaibo to the same extent as the River Plate area or Lima, for example. But again, there are kind of early instances of football. There is at the end of the 19th century, I think in 1894, 1896, there are some Italian priests who apparently established some football in some of their kind of religious schools. And in 1902, there's a first football team in Caracas. It's called San Bernardino FC, and it's formed by two Scotsmen, David and Jimmy Ballantyne, who I think might have even played for Arsenal. I didn't actually track that down, see that if that was true or not. But really, that's the start of it. The first league is created in 1921. There are only two teams in this first particular instance. It gradually starts growing, again, really focused on the kind of central areas of the country. And again, in actually a fairly similar time to Colombia, actually. In 1925, in the 1930s, is when Venezuela becomes affiliated to FIFA. And we see the kind of the first kind of professional league, actually not for another 20 years, in 1957. So I think what you can really say about Venezuela is that it takes a long time to really get established. There's very little British influence. And actually the real kind of the drivers of football in Venezuela actually are Portuguese emigrants, Spanish emigrants, and Italian emigrants, much more than any Brits.
It's good that your knowledge isn't up to much. I was worried you wouldn't know a lot. Gary, I suppose first question is, I suppose, you know, listen to what Peter said there, and as he's mentioned, you know, a lot of it was very British influence in terms of origins, but do you think, and again, this is a very difficult question to answer, I apologise, but do you think where you have a nation where anything is sort of originated or inspired by a multinational or multi-nation concept, do you think it's better or worse for the growth of the game or development of a game when you have multiple nations influencing it at the very beginning?
I guess my first inclination would say it would be better because obviously the more different threads you get weaved into the fabric of football, a nice metaphor there. But that's obviously producing a better cloth, shall we say. And I think it's interesting that Pete says, Dr. Pete says there about the Portuguese and Spanish influence in Venezuela, because Venezuela's always been, and he mentioned about it was a long time coming in football in Venezuela, and they didn't get a professional league until the late 50s, I think, Pete. And but I think they're still the only Commonwealth nation not to qualify for a World Cup.
Yeah.
So Venezuela almost seems to be the latecomers to almost everything in football. And whether that's relevant to the fact that the influences in Venezuela is more to do with the Iberian Peninsula than the British Isles, I'm not sure, but perhaps it might be. Interesting things about that.
It's funny. I mean, I suppose, like you say, talking about the professional league, and I suppose, Stephen, this is quite an obvious question, but in terms of, you know, if football is to develop within a nation, that development of a professional league is obviously really, really crucial.
Yeah, I think our version of this, you know, because we've had the Football League being around since 1888, I think our time scale over how everyone else adopted their leagues and leagues turned professional is quite demanding in a way. You know, if you think about kind of how the Bundesliga didn't start until the early 1960s, you know, they were effectively on an amateur foot in themselves until then. You know, the Eredivisie, you know, was very much a semi kind of like semi pro part time kind of league until the mid to late 1960s. So, you know, I think sometimes our, not demands isn't the right word, but our expectations of how everyone were as quick as England and Scotland and the British game was in adapting, you know, within that, I think it's kind of like, you know, you consider how fragmented and how chaotic South American football, club football can be. Within that respect, I think Venezuela ties into everyone else. But at the same time, to be able to boast a professional league from the late 1950s is actually quite forward-thinking when compared to other nations. And I think it's also under the consideration that it's not really a traditional football-playing nation. You know, they are such a fascinating oddity, Venezuela, in that, you know, the national sport has been baseball, you know, provided so many players to the national, you know, the highest leagues of baseball, you know, in America. And it is, I think that there is a, it, for me, you know, looking on the outside, looking in, there is at least a theoretical structure to it, you know, and whether that's been followed through in a practical sense and it's been, you know, a well-run league is another matter. But, you know, I think it's a big plus to them that they've come forward and found a league and moved forward from the late 1950s. You know, I think that's to the credit.
But I mean, you know, Pete, I mean, for me, do you? I know I asked Gary the question about, you know, whether the, you know, it creates a more well-rounded introduction to the game if you have a multinational influence. But do you think, had it have been a Brit, and this is not a jingoistic thing by any means by me, but had it have been a more British initial influence, do you think they would have been quicker to catch up, like maybe some of the other South American nations?
I think it certainly would have helped. I mean, I think that you just have to look at where the British trade interests are in South America for where the trade develops quickest. You know, I mean, the great ports of South America are, you know, are the River Plate down in Buenos Aires, Montevideo. You've got Valparaiso in Chile, you've got Lima, you know, and so on. And actually, that's kind of part of the problem. You know, British didn't really go to Caracas and actually didn't really go to Colombia as well. And I think that part of the reason why, you know, football particularly, but sport generally, I suppose, develops slightly more quickly in, you know, the places that has more of a British mercantile interest and therefore more elites who will be playing these type of sports and bring them back with them, is that they kind of develop in line with each other. For example, Montevideo and Buenos Aires are very close to each other. And obviously those early games between teams from Uruguay and teams from Argentina, they then become seen as being Argentina versus Uruguay internationals, are quite quick to develop because there are kind of parallel processes going on and they can kind of feed off each other. You know, it's not particularly difficult to get round to Valparaiso and Chile. So Chile kind of ties in, you know, Rio de Janeiro, again, is not particularly far away. So there is connections there. So that's why the kind of the southern cone in South America developed quite quickly. You know, in contrast, though, you know, Colombia, again, we talked about this a few weeks ago, but Colombia's football is also very slow to develop. And again, it's quite fragmented. It's been played in regional leagues and they're quite a long way away from the Venezuelan border. So it's quite difficult for Venezuela, for example, had there been any sport, you know, or any football, to play games against another national team, to have these kind of international meetings, create a kind of sense of patriotic pride, which would stimulate further development of the game. And actually, so I suppose Venezuela's traditionally looked north rather than south for its kind of sporting influence. And that's why we see, you know, as Steve said, this is why we kind of get baseball, because, you know, Cuba, for example, which is already a kind of a baseball nation with the American, you know, kind of impact on sugar, the tobacco industry. And again, Cubans bring tobacco farms across to Venezuela, and that kind of starts the process of baseball. Similarly, the US get interested in the kind of petroleum, and that kind of is the real boost that means that baseball, rather than football, is the sport that kind of develops. So I suppose it's a case of, you know, this kind of different kind of pulls of where the kind of neighbourly influence is coming from. The southern cone have got more British influence, they play more British games, and they kind of feed off each other, whereas Venezuela, Colombia, you know, and the kind of the Caribbean nations are slightly more isolated. And again, if you think about it, obviously, you know, the likes of Guyana, you know, is a cricket nation. Suriname is kind of slightly further along and slightly difficult to access as well. So I think it's the problems of accessing, you know, other influences, other sporting influences in Latin America as much as kind of European influences.
It's a great point, you know, obviously by Stephen and by yourself as well. And I suppose it links nicely to, I suppose, the culture and identity. Obviously, you know, we've done Colombia, we've done Brazil, we've done Peru, and the, you know, the culture and the identity and the relationship with football has been quite clear throughout. But here, I suppose, you know, the relationship between football and, you know, the identity of Venezuela, the culture of Venezuela, maybe not quite so obvious as our previous episodes.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's really the case. And again, you know, you're looking at reasons why a sport might develop. And a lot of the time it will develop due to visibility, due to media attention. But you need success. You know, success is really important. And, you know, I mean, Argentina and Uruguay had British teams coming over. That kind of, you know, that kind of built up a sense of us versus them. Venezuela never really had that. You know, I mean, I haven't really looked into it, but I really don't know if any British teams, European teams went across to play in Venezuela. On the flip side, though, they did get success in baseball. And I think it's in 1941. The Venezuelan national baseball team wins what is effectively the World Cup and will win it a couple more times in the 1940s. So for Venezuela to be triumphant in this particular sport, beating the Cubans, I think probably beating the Dominican Republic, which has a similarly really strong baseball tradition, that becomes the source of these national myths and therefore the kind of source of, you know, what, you know, young boys, again, who are obviously, it's kind of, you know, very much a masculine activity, you know, at the time, obviously. These are the kind of things that young boys want to emulate. This generation of 1941, you know, this path to America, which is very much the kind of dream at the time and very much part of the, you know, the kind of national associations and national linkages are much more looking to America. So that's why kind of baseball really establishes itself as, you know, as the Venezuelan national sport. You know, football, as we've already said, has been played, you know, predominantly by, or it's been set up by a lot of these kind of Italian, Portuguese and Spanish teams, rather than necessarily having a really Venezuelan influence. So that's kind of part of the reason why it takes so long for Venezuelan football to really become something that is more culturally competing with baseball, at least in a sporting, on a sporting way for national identity. I mean, it's all down to success, and that really doesn't occur until, you know, well into the 21st century, really.
It's, I mean, Gary, I know you seem to be copying for the question, just the order that they're in tonight. But in terms of, how am I trying to say this? With regards to, you know, trying to establish an identity and, you know, and I suppose as English, and maybe I'm as guilty as anyone else, but because football is my love, nations who don't traditionally play football, I don't overtly pay a lot of attention to them or know a lot about them. You know, Steve, we've joked about our history through the politics podcast. Steve and I joke about our GCSE geography based on midweek sports special and sports night. And I suppose, you know, does Venezuela in a way suffer from the fact that football is such a majority, you know, played by the majority of the globe as a national sport, that's where it kind of suffers from a lack of knowledge and interest, I guess, from the rest of the world?
Yeah, I'm sure it's true. You know, if people talk about South America and football, they tend to sort of put the whole continent in the same block and think, you know, everything's the same and, you know, the influences are the same and everybody loves football and it's the massive game there in all the South American countries. And the only sweeping generalisation that's ever true is that all sweeping generalisations are wrong. And, you know, and Venezuela is a classic example, as Pete just been describing, you know, and baseball as dominant sport, almost by definition, forces football into a minority situation, and therefore it takes a lot longer for football to become influential in the culture of Venezuela, and that's not right or wrong, it's just true. You know, the influence of baseball, as Dr. Pete mentioned, in Cuba, it becomes in most countries it's dominant sport. You know, in England and most European countries it's football. In other countries, that's not the case. And we mustn't sort of assume that it is the case just because in South America, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, football is the dominant sport. Not true everywhere. So we must sort of accept and understand that Venezuela is a country where that's not true. And baseball is the dominant sport. And football is therefore, you know, it becomes a secondary, almost subsidiary sport and struggle to become prominent in the consciousness of kids growing up in Venezuela want to succeed in a sporting endeavour.
Stephen, this is going to sound awful, I don't mean for it to. Do you think, because obviously, you know, I've learned stuff already tonight, but do you think, certainly, and I'm not speaking for you three guys, I'm not, But do you think it's a very English thing where if a country doesn't have football as its national sport, we become very patronising towards it and pat it on the head and say, oh, bless, you know, we can help you if you want. You know, that sort of almost, don't worry, it'll be okay. Once you find it, everything will be okay with you. It's almost that, well, if you don't love football, you know, if you don't like football, football's not the national sport, there must be something wrong, but we'll help you with it. You know, do you think that's an English thing, or is it a worldwide sort of issue?
It's a good one, that. Certainly, from my perspective, I can fully agree that, you know, parts of the world and parts of the country I live in, you know, I know little about because they don't play football, or there's not much in the way of football. You know, of all the places in the UK that I am the least familiar with, I'd probably say it's the South East and the West Country, simply because, you know, as a travelling football fan, I've been there the least in terms of getting to football matches. So, you know, yeah, certain parts of the world, you know, I think there's a cuddly aspect to nations that don't tie into football quite as passionately as we do. You know, I'll point maybe a New Zealand would be a fine example of that. You know, a huge rugby and cricketing nation that have tipped up at a couple of World Cups, and I think, you know, Canada would be another one. You know, having seen, and probably is that respect. But within those countries, I mean, I've seen, there's a great documentary on the Canadian national team that made the 1986 World Cup, for instance. And, you know, the way that they were received in their own country, you know, there was a huge enthusiasm for it, but it was all taken by surprise. And, you know, they were learning about their own team as well. So there's a flip side of it. You know, yes, you know, a nation that, you know, embraces football passionately and very seriously might not take a nation that doesn't quite so seriously. But within that, you know, their own nations will look at it that way. You know, if football is coming in third, fourth, fifth on the list of national sports, then, you know, they come under the radar. So within that, when a golden generation tips up, you know, they kind of have a better chance of succeeding because of the lack of pressure, you know. And I think this kind of like bears out a little bit with Venezuela and how that fine rise of theirs 10 years ago, decade or so ago, you know, that's only just petering out now, has come to pass.
It's a great point, Angie. And I suppose, you know, just before we move on to the next, what, you know, the next sort of topic, be about, you know, the domestic scene, and you touched on it recently, but again, is a, that, you know, a golden generation, is that something that sort of fledgling nations need? In any sport, you know, it doesn't have to be football, it can be rugby, it can be cricket, hockey, you know, whatever it is. You know, do nations need that coming together of a group of talented players all at the same time in order to establish a foothold within their own country, never mind in the global game?
Yeah, no, I think you do. I mean, I think that we're kind of looking at what you need for sporting nationalism here, you know, where a sport can become kind of representative and symbolic of a nation, its people, and kind of move masses. So it kind of gains this kind of, you know, political respectability. It becomes part of the media narrative, but also becomes part of the popular conscious played by as a kind of a large, you know, an impactful football mass. I mean, there's, you know, kind of when I wrote my thesis, one of the things that I was really building on was the work of an Argentinian anthropologist called Eduardo Arquetti, and Pablo Alabarces is a brilliant kind of Argentinian football academic. And they talk about the importance of four real pillars for what you need for sporting nationalism to occur. And that is, you know, you need the game to become creolized in the Latin American culture, i.e. it needs to kind of move from being something only played by the British or the Americans or the Spanish or the Portuguese, whoever, and it needs to become Venezuelan. You need to kind of develop, you need to have success, because otherwise it doesn't get in the media and therefore it doesn't get recognized and people don't want to play it. Part of the same issue, the kind of third pillar is heroes. You know, I mean, let's face it, when we were all kids, I'm sure we all ran around wanting to be someone, you know, whoever it was that we saw on telly playing for the team we supported. So you need to have that as well. Those heroes need to be visible. And then you kind of need a style. And Venezuela doesn't really have any of those. You know, and I think that, you know, part of the problem kind of is as well with the fact that, going back to kind of the question you were asking Steve as well, is that there's kind of like a competing sporting hegemonic struggle that Venezuela is really interesting, because, you know, we have the kind of British sports, you know, and the impact that they've made around the world, you know, football being the prime example in Latin America, you know, to a lesser extent rugby, but, you know, rugby was there. We talked about how it started off in Lima. how cricket was in Lima, but it was also in Uruguay and rugby, you know, in Argentina and Chile as well. Venezuela didn't get that. Instead, Venezuela gets the kind of the America, the US influence. So there's this kind of the US games, you know, particularly baseball, to a lesser extent, maybe basketball, volleyball. The games that aren't really British, and they're almost kind of the one kind of nation that gets affected by a different hegemonic cultural power force, you know, that compete against us. And I think actually that one of the reasons why, you know, Britain tends to look down on, you know, nation, or maybe there is this kind of snobbery against, you know, for example, American sports for a long time, is that they're not ours. They're things that we did not create. You had to create your own ones. You didn't accept ours because ours are better. You know what I mean? It's kind of that feeling a little bit. So I kind of wonder whether, you know, we tend to say, yeah, well, baseball's just a crap form of cricket, and, you know, basketball was just, you know, something that you could create just so you could score lots of points. And American football, you needed a breather because you weren't fit enough to play rugby and you can't protect yourself. You know, those are those kind of slightly snobbish arguments. But I think that's kind of partly true about why we maybe look down on, you know, sporting achievements in baseball, for example. You know.
It's a great point. I always think America wanted to be world champions at stuff, so they just only enter their own teams and that's it.
That's part of it, isn't it? You know.
If Canada pops along and wins something, they're devastated. So in terms of the domestic scene then, you know, obviously with Legend League, you know, still relatively new. I mean, who are the, I suppose, the dominant forces in the domestic game?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting question. I mean, I'm gonna mention a guy called Jordan Florett here. I think a few of us have read his book. I think he's been on These Football Times before. I mean, he's written a great book about Venezuelan football. And he really talks about the kind of club scene, and he follows some of the clubs around. And one of the things that really comes out in his book is the temporary nature of many of these clubs. These are clubs that are in flux. They seem to be coming and going. They kind of last for 10, 15 years and maybe struggle financially and disappear again. And so what's really interesting about the Venezuelan league is that, you know, whereas in lots of leagues, there are certain titans, you know, who have won 30, 25 titles. They've always been there. They were founded when the league started and they've always been there. You know, in Venezuela, that isn't really quite the case. I mean, the biggest team really seems to be Caracas. They've won 12 titles. Deportivo Táchira have won 8. But the team in third who've won the next most is a team called Unión, who won 7 titles. But they won them from, I think, 1932 to 1950 and don't exist anymore. Dos Caminos have won 6 titles. They don't exist anymore. So that's the thing. You know, some of the clubs that made an early impact, and you would think that, you know, the clubs that would make an early impact would continue because there is this successful trend. They would carry on. But I mean, one of the interesting things, again, if you were to look at the current league, and I had a look at this because I was really interested to see the kind of history, you know, the history of these clubs. If you look at the current Venezuelan Football League, I think the team, I'm just kind of consulting my notes, I think the team that's been in existence the longest is Carabobo, who were formed in 1964. You've got Caracas from 1967. But then in the same league, you've got teams like Academia Puerto Cabello, who were formed in 2011. We've got Atletico Venezuela, 2011, Deportivo La Guaira, 2008, GV Maracay, 2014. So this is interesting. You know, you've got clubs in the first division who've won a few titles, who've only really been in existence maybe 12, 10, you know, 6 years in the case of Maracay. And that's a kind of a very different phenomenon than you'll get in really anywhere else in the continent. I mean, the league is constantly in a state of flux. There are certain teams like, I think, Zulia have done relatively well. Táchira have got a bit of a reputation as well. But it is a kind of a nation where you don't find, I mean, in Caracas are about as close to a, you know, the giant team as you're probably going to get.
I mean, I suppose, you know, Gary, you know, going back to, you know, we talked about cultural identity. So I suppose it's really difficult if you've got a domestic league where, you know, it's almost seems like almost like a franchise basis, which again is very similar to American sports, where teams will start up and, you know, granted America do have those traditional titans, as Pete called them, but you can also have franchises where they'll up and move or rename and rebrand. So I suppose it's always going to be difficult to form cultural relationships between fans and clubs if clubs are either brand new or constantly on the move?
Absolutely. I'm not sure how the fan affiliation work in Venezuela, but as Pete just mentioned, we talk about clubs that have been in existence for 25 years, and in England we have these sort of, you know, the club affiliations are passed down from grandfathers to fathers to sons, etc. down these sort of generations, and you know, you don't have a choice in your sport because that's who your father supports or that's where you live or whatever. But it must be difficult to have that, to have any kind of similar affiliation with clubs that have sort of existed for 10 years, 15 years, because they just don't have that cachet. There's no emotional attachment, I guess. That's only earned over time. And I guess the Venezuelan league must be, I wouldn't say poorer, but I'm going to say poorer because of that.
Just off the top of my head there, Stephen, if you think about, you know, what, especially with the term of franchise, you look at what's happening in China, and obviously China are newer to this than even Venezuela are. But it's again that where clubs can come and clubs can go, and you know, and China is still struggling to establish a foothold, you know, in the global game. Yes, they have more money. Yes, they have a state government that is putting money into this, but domestically it still seems to be that fractured relationship between fans and clubs, because clubs either aren't sustainable or there isn't necessarily a desire from the Chinese public to sustain clubs over a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, there's a boom and bust element to it, you know, and attracting kind of like support has got to be an absolute minefield for these teams. And, you know, Pete's already mentioned some of those teams, but, you know, it's interesting that the most successful sides, you know, because they're short-lived, the success tends to be in clusters. Yes, Caracas, you know, with 12 league titles, but the first of those came in like 92. There isn't that, like it's, you know, Pete said, that longevity, you know, that generational element of, like Gary said, handing your team over to your son and him handing it over to his son, and through the generations, it's not going to be there. But this is where you end up having, you know, La Liga will be absolutely massive in Venezuela, as it is across so many of the South American nations. You know, I don't know for certain, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, kids walk around and kick a football around the streets of Caracas in Real Madrid and Barcelona shirts. I'd be amazed if they didn't. But within this, you know, I think it probably helps, you know, foster the potential to almost make the national side like a club team. If you're looking as a football fan for something that is a constant and is always going to be there, then your national team will always be there. Yeah, that potential for the national team to be huge, you know, is absolutely evident. You know, I think it's going to be a, you know, if they can crack that first World Cup, you know, the potential for support and certainly towards the national game would be absolutely huge.
It's, I mean, again, you know, obviously your knowledge is incredible, but in terms of government support, Venezuelan FA or the equivalent of Venezuelan FA, you know, how do they, or certainly the state government, you know, how do they see, or where do they prioritise football compared to, as you say, the sports that have come from the Americas? You know, Venezuelan FA, are they a powerful sports body like the FA are in this country, for example?
So I think really, you know, that any government is not going to really support a losing cause. You know, that's one of the things that they're not going to be attached to. So the fact that, you know, for so many years, Venezuela, you know, doesn't win a game in international competition. I mean, but, you know, the first attempt to actually qualify for the World Cup wasn't until 1966. You know, the only real participation they'd had in kind of organised international tournaments before that is a little bit in the Copa America, but mostly in the kind of Central American and Caribbean games, which isn't really a major tournament. So really, you know, where governments are looking for sources of national pride from kind of cultural perspectives, you know, they're trying to find some success, and that's why they invest in baseball, because there is a route, you know, there, you know, and 1941 provides that reason. And again, the same kind of thing happens with, you know, I suppose sponsors, with people who do have money in the kind of oil boom years when Venezuela was, you know, was modernizing, was industrializing, was benefiting from the oil boom. And when there were these close relations with the obviously aren't there anymore. You know, I mean, I wonder whether, you know, I mean, it's something that I'm not sure if there's research on this, but I would suspect that with the kind of the decaying of the relationship with the US, with, you know, the Hugo Chavez years in particular, I wonder whether there is a slight move away from favouring the traditional American sports to trying to look really at maybe more European sports. I wonder if that's something that you could try and draw a line. But I suppose that really the first time when there's real, I suppose, more significant investment from the government really comes in 2007. You know, this is where Venezuela hosts the Copa America for the first time, you know, in the long history of this tournament. It takes to 2007 for that to happen. But again, you need to have some success before that. And in 2002, in that kind of qualifying regime, the manager called Richard Páez, his team won four games in a row. And this has mythic connotations in Venezuelan football. This is the birth of Venezuelan football, where they win four games in a single World Cup qualifiers and they do it in a row. You know, I mean, we're talking about a team that went whole World qualifiers, Copa America qualifiers, without winning a game. So it has to take that. You know, the football team almost has to do something first. And there has to be a slightly different political scenario where maybe they're looking at, you know, different sporting examples. You know, Cuba is also a little bit of an example from that kind of anti-US narrative. But again, that's baseball, really. But I suppose that, you know, I mean, again, part of the problem there is now, and again, that you do have a young generation now. I mean, the 2017 team, I mean, it was an absolute watershed moment when that under-20 team, you know, got to the finals of the World Cup. They lost to England 2017. That was a massive achievement. And that is the golden moment. That's where kids in Venezuela are looking at Adalberto Peñaranda and, you know, all these kind of young stars who are now starting to play in Europe and playing in the US and think, I could be them. This could be my way out. But this unfortunately coincides with, you know, this appalling, you know, humanitarian and economic crisis that's going on in Venezuela at the moment. So there isn't the money to invest in, you know, this is the golden generation. This is where it starts. But the money isn't there to boost that. So I think that, you know, Venezuela has really struggled. You know, the Football Federation, the government hasn't really either seen an interest or hasn't had the money or has seen kind of more auspicious areas to kind of use a sport for this kind of cultural, political capital that it might need.
They're all fascinating points. And I mean, you know, coming, you know, I think we talked about it in the Peru episode, I think, you know, the World Cup qualifying competition in South America, Gary, is horrendously difficult. Arguably the most, I think it was you, Pete, that said it last time, arguably, you know, it's the most difficult competition to get a positive result from. You know, I mean, Venezuela, most nations, unless you are Brazil and Argentina, and again, we've mentioned times when even Argentina haven't qualified, Uruguay haven't qualified. You know, so for Venezuela to qualify for a World Cup, they couldn't be in a more difficult situation to qualify as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's like sort of, I mean, I was going to say the Faroe Islands, but that's too harsh. But it is difficult when, you know, they've got the sort of Leviathans, like Brazil and Argentina, and then you've got Uruguay, Peru, and Venezuela, to qualify for a World Cup from that tournament. It's a massive ask, and it's probably not surprising that they've never achieved it. But it's interesting that, you know, Pete mentioned a few minutes ago that they reached the final of the 2017 Under-20 World Cup. So perhaps there's hope that, you know, the connection with the USA and sports like basketball and particularly baseball are becoming less important, and perhaps football is becoming is increasing in popularity and attracting more sporting excellence to that particular genre. And let's hope so, because you know, it's a sad tale that, you know, Venezuela is the only Commonwealth nation that hasn't qualified for a World Cup. And you know, the way FIFA are going, I mean, the Faroe Islands are going to qualify for the World Cup. The way they're going. So I mean, you know, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know, it would be great to have, you know, why should Venezuela be missing out? And, you know, the Hugo Chavez thing is an interesting thing that Pete mentioned earlier. And I want to put political aside for a little bit, but I'm going to struggle. Spending the all wealth of a country on the poor people of the country is not a bad thing. And if that develops a detachment from America, What are you going to do, guys? What are you going to do?
Stephen, well, we always leave the politics to Gary because he's pretty good at it. In terms of, you know, we've talked about certainly, you know, Brazil and the sort of the movement of players from Brazil across to Europe. And, you know, we sort of, you know, for the national game and national identity, you know, and sort of creating a love affair between fans and players. You know, we've talked about, you know, Brazilian players or South American players staying longer. But do you think that, you know, with this talented crop, this under-20s crop that's coming through, do they need to go to Europe or need to go to more established playing nations in order for the national team to do well? You know, is that a converse sort of situation than the one we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the natural gravity. You know, every nation has had that. You know, England have had that. If you look at the exodus of players that went to play in Serie A in the 1980s, you know, some went to La Liga, you know, even to France. You know, it's all to do with that upward arc and, you know, the improvements in technical terms and bringing the game back to the mother nation, basically. So for the Venezuelan players to strike out there and to, you know, to improve a football, to be able to bring a better style of football back. But it also works on another side, is that it inspires the next generation of player. You know, you can look at, you know, any nation, you know, look at the squads that have gone to Copa Americas, for instance, or World Cups of certain nations, and then how it will blossom, but at least, you know, it will expand from kind of like none to one or two to half the squad to predominantly the squad being out there playing their football elsewhere. And, you know, in Venezuela, you know, they have a blueprint to follow. They can look at, you know, how Bolivia got to the 94 World Cup. They can look at how Ecuador, you know, rose. And Ecuador were in exactly the same boat as Venezuela, where money wasn't spent hugely on football. I think it was it 2006, their first World Cup? And I can remember when Ecuador tipped up at the World Cup for the first time. You know, in the group they were drawn into, which might have had a couple of European sides in it. And up to that point, they'd only ever played three European nations before qualifying for that World Cup. So, you know, they upped that in the friendlies that were warm games for the tournament. And, you know, so Venezuela, you know, they're treading a path that others have done before them. And players going out there and playing overseas, you know, is just a part of that. And I think especially for Venezuelan football, when, you know, when we've said how fragmented it is, how short some teams can be around, you know, there is no great history and infrastructure of, you know, lasting teams. You know, where is Venezuela's El Clasico, you know, for instance? What is the, you know, the biggest game? Yes, you can look at it in contemporary terms, but, you know, generation on generation, year on year, decade on decade, those big teams have changed, you know, and as Peter said, some have come, some have gone, you know, and the ones that are prospering today might not even be around in a decade's time. So yes, those Venezuelan players who are coming through, especially as part of that up-and-coming youth system and team, they need to get out there and just expand their horizons, and within that, take their nation with them.
I suppose it sounds relatively hopeful. I think I like to think we're sort of on an upward trend in terms of our hopes for Venezuela. But I suppose, you know, just to finish off with then, guys, you know, is, you know, where do we, or certainly for you, Pete, to begin with, you know, the future of the game in Venezuela, is it, not saying it's all about qualification for the World Cup, but is that the big step?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's what they've got to achieve. I mean, the under-20 World Cup final was a massive moment. You know, I mean, we can't underestimate how big a surprise that was for Latin America, how big an impact for national pride it had, the kind of visibility it gave, you know, the nation, the fact that a lot of these young players are now playing in decent teams in Europe. You know, and there's no getting away from the fact that they're having an impact. You know, the path that, you know, Juan Arango was treading, you know, on his own, you know, at Mallorca and then I think Mönchengladbach. You know, he was on his own. Now they can point to, you know, a number of players who've got a chance, who are playing in La Liga, who are playing in Germany, who are playing in, you know, at least on the bench in Britain, for example. And, you know, and again, what this also means is that this isn't a team that are also around anymore. You know, they're not You know, people aren't going to Venezuela think, oh, we'll stuff them 5-6-0. We just have to turn up and win. You know, when Colombia play, when Ecuador play, when Uruguay play, when Paraguay go and play Venezuela, they've got a tough game now. You know, it's not easy. You know, this is a nation that can compete and can get 20 points in South American qualifiers. So that's been a massive step. The problem, obviously, they have is that the financial issues in the country, are not going to help the kind of club scene really develop. But I think that, you know, like Jorge Valdano, you know, once said, you know, poverty is not great for many things, but it does provide football. You know, football has emerged from it. So Venezuela, you know, unfortunately might have that. We might see a boom of young kids who are looking at Salomon Rondon, at, you know, Peñaranda, at Yangel Herrera, at Cordoba. You know, these guys that were in the 2017 team and are now playing in Germany and Spain and sort of think, I want to be them. I can make it. I can get to the US. I can get to Spain. I can get to Germany. And that can only be beneficial. You know, I suppose the problem is how well they can kind of stitch that kind of team together, how well they can keep them in the unit and kind of build that selection. But, you know, Venezuela have a chance. You know, they certainly have a chance to make it very difficult to be on the edges of that fifth team that qualified. And that can only be beneficial for the sporting prospects of the nation.
It's, I mean, I know you don't like this question, Gary, and I'm really sorry, but obviously, like, you know, last time we worked out 6.5 places now available for the CONMEBOL region. So there's only, well, I'll say 3.5 teams, but best case scenario, only 3 teams don't go. Is this the reason why FIFA have done it? Is there a small part of us, or a small part of you really, Gary, that is quite happy that FIFA's opened itself up just so teams like Venezuela can get this foothold in the game?
You know, you sort of, you know, teams get what they deserve, and, you know, and the qualifying tournament to South America is so harsh. It's terribly harsh, you know. It's not like in Europe where you finish third and you get a playoff chance against somebody else. Or, I mean, it's ridiculously hard, and Venezuela have suffered because of this. But as you know, as Dr. Pete mentioned there, you know, there were players like Salomon Rondon, who played for West Bromwich Albion and Newcastle United, Juan Arango, Josef Martinez, who played for Torino, Robert Rosales, who played for Leganés. There are players coming through from Venezuela who are playing for top teams in Europe, not to the extent that Brazilians or Argentinians are, or perhaps even Colombians or Peruvians, but they're emerging, and it's encouraging to see that Venezuelan football is developing and producing players that can play a regular part in European teams. It is difficult to see Venezuela are going to qualify from the South American groups, because if they do, they're going to have to push out teams like perhaps Colombia, perhaps Peru, perhaps Bolivia, and that's going to be difficult. Is it going to happen? I mean, I don't know. It would be great, because, you know, South American football is a hotbed of football, and why should Venezuela miss out? It would be great to have them into the family of football qualifying nations at the World Cup.
It's pretty question at the end, kind of half answer. I was going to ask Stephen and just put him on the spot. Will Venezuela in our lifetime, Stephen, I'll pick you and I, in our lifetime, will Venezuela, and I plan on living to about 80, will Venezuela qualify for the World Cup in our lifetime?
Yes, I like to hope so. I think it was 2014, they got to within the last 3 or 4 games, and they were in with a serious shout. And this was of an era where it's 5 teams qualifying, and they were in with a massive, massive shout, you know, to get that close. And we're talking about a team that reached the semi-finals of the Copa America in 2011 when it was played in Argentina. They came to within a penalty shootout to reach in the final. You know, so they've had that first spike of inspiration, you know, that team that has gone and enthralled the nation. You know, they came to within the semi-finals of a major final, you know, and then a youth side has gone to their own respective age-specific, you know, world final. So, you know, that genesis has come now, you know, and it's what they do to build on that now. You know, there are kids now kicking the ball around, thinking that they can be part of that team that breaks, you know, that cracks the code and takes Venezuela to a World Cup. You know, Brazil and Argentina will always reach the finals. They'll have the odd flutter here and there, but they always will. But the great thing about the CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers has always been that all the other nations tend to work on a yo-yo scale. They'll have a certain amount of years where they're riding the crest of a wave, and then they will dip. And that's even been Uruguay. You know, there's been songs where Uruguay have struggled to qualify and failed to qualify for World Cups. You know, Colombia, great Colombia eras, they've come and gone. Chile, you know, Peru, like we said last time, you know, they went 82 to 2018 without qualifying for a World Cup. You know, Paraguay have come and gone, you know, themselves. Ecuador had their rise and have now drifted off. You know, Bolivia reached the summit in 94, but have been pretty abject since, apart from one brief rise. So there is always this, you know, ray of light that if they can put a compelling run of games and a team together that rides the crest of their own wave, there is no reason why Venezuela can't sneak in and be that fifth or sixth team, you know, whether that's in a playoff or reaching the finals automatically. There's no reason why they can't just sneak in. You know, if Peru can do it, if Ecuador can qualify, you know, which they have, and Bolivia have been there as well, there is now no reason why Venezuela can't follow suit.
It's a good answer. It's a nice way to finish. Guys, as always, you know, it's been great. Obviously, I've learned a lot, but it's been a great chat in that there's been no, certainly on my part, no preconceived ideas of what we were going to talk about in terms of, you know, what would come out. When you talk about Brazil, you know what's going to come out, you know the subject, whereas this has been very much, for me certainly, a stimulating conversation in that most things were new, the topics of conversation were the same, but the answers were very, very different. And obviously that's because of the nature of Venezuela and its geographical location. And like as Pete said, it's the influences on the nation is very, very different to the countries that we've talked about so far. It was great. I loved it. Really, really good chat. Gary, obviously it's dark now where you are. So either we've been on far longer than I thought we had, or the sun sets quite quickly in Venezuela.
Yeah, about 2 miles from Caracas, this is what happens. I just to throw in that I saw a thing on Twitter, which is worth mentioning, that obviously, you know, the coronavirus issue. There was a Venezuela female footballer who said that they've been 5 months without pay and locked down 1,000 miles from home. Diana Perez was her name, and she said that the female footballers of Venezuela have been forgotten, and perhaps it's important to remember that, you know, in football, Venezuela still isn't seen as a major issue. But perhaps that'll change. Perhaps it should change. Let's hope it does. And, you know, it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing.
It is. And to be fair, this is why I'm not saying we're doing this to change the world in Venezuela, but it's about creating awareness, you know, and educating people in, you know, about football in countries that maybe perhaps, you know, they don't know that much about. And like I say, I'm certainly one of them. Stephen, as always, thank you very much. If you need to get back to your 24-hour party, you're now free to go. go rejoin the party.
I'll head to the fridge and crack open that latest beer.
And obviously Pete, as always, just brilliant. If that's your lack of knowledge, I can't wait to visit a country that you're kind of happy with and know a bit about.
Cheers, always good to talk about it. And it's fun to talk about those countries that, you know, we don't get to normally, you know, discuss and talk about the issues and kind of political and historical and cultural things that pressurise them as well. So yeah, always a good laugh, always good fun to talk to you guys as well.
Excellent. Obviously we have plenty more of these for those of you, obviously with 10 South American nations, and we've done 4. The maps are pretty straightforward. So there's plenty more episodes of these to come, and we'll see you again on the next episode of the South American Files.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.